There's a lot to say when buying a new home or car, but only one thing to say that can help you protect them. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. And just like that, a State Farm agent will be there to help you choose the coverage you need, no matter where you are in life. When you need coverage options, your State Farm agent is there to help, on the phone or in person. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery. Code Wondery.
Welcome to the Eddie Tinti podcast number 998. If you're going to be in Nashville, Tennessee, my home state of Tennessee, not my home city, but my home state. Nashville's pretty great, though, I got to be honest. I'm going to be at Zany's May 30th through June 1st. And then the following weekend, I will be at Wise Guys in Salt Lake City. Tickets are at id10t.com, as well as a bunch of other fun stuff. So please go there and support all that business. But now let's support you, the ID10T community, by going to events at ID10T.com with your emails for events on the corkboard. Just like this one. Hey, want to get cute portraits of your pets and help a wonderful organization? Then make sure to check out the Happy Pup Up event at Leanna Lynn's Wonderland this Sunday in Eagle Rock, Los Angeles. By this Sunday, I believe they mean May 5th. So there will be numerous artists there that you can commission to do portraits of your pets. You can either bring your pet or a photo. All the proceeds help Home Dog LA, an organization who helps families get the resources they need to keep their pets. There will be ice cream and more again Sunday, May 5th at Leanna Lynn's Wonderland in Eagle Rock on Eagle Rock Boulevard. Also, Tome writes, we were listening to ID10T while building props at a nonprofit theater, and I started, and I thought I would give you a heads up. After 2 years of fighting with city council, we finally opened! Yes! Millrace Theatrical Company is a nonprofit performing arts theater and makerspace located in Mount Holly, New Jersey, near Philadelphia. We teach free classes in acting, special effects, design, engineering, and everything related to live storytelling. Our goal is to connect with people through the arts and give them an experience they can't reproduce at home or on their devices. Our Big Spring Comedy is running until early June, and then we go into production on the fall horror show, Theater of Fear. Well, both of those sound amazing. Thank you. Thank you for making a thing called Theater of Fear. You can also learn more about us on our website, millracetheatricalcompany.com, or our social networks at Millrace Theater, but it's spelled tra-theatra. So there you go. This episode, Craigie Ferg is back. He just poked his head into the United States for like a minute, and then he went back over to Scotland. But he has a new memoir called Riding the Elephant, a memoir of altercations, humiliations, hallucinations, and observations. And it is out May 7th. So support Craig Ferguson. I love that guy. I miss him. I miss seeing him on the television. I miss seeing him in my life. And he's just someone that I've been friends with for an incredibly long period of time. He's very open about sobriety. He's very open about mental health, and he certainly has been someone who has been inspiring and helpful to me, not just as a performer, but also as a sober person. So, Craigie, I love you, and thank you for being on this episode of the ID10T podcast, which is number 998. And now, roll it!
Initiating ID10T protocol.
All right, God bless you. I'm so sorry. That wasn't a power play, by the way. I really, it's not something I learned in business school or anything like that.
The trick is you gotta show up 12 minutes late.
12 minutes late and get them to make you a coffee. Then they know who's boss.
Then you piss in their bathroom and you don't flush the toilet. That's how you
do it. No, I flushed it. Did I flush?
No, I don't know.
No, I think I flushed. Well, I didn't do is I didn't leave a thing in the guest book.
Oh, yeah, there's a guest book in
there. Well, I left a little smidge of poo.
Oh, that's so nice. So there is...
Smidge of poo.
So that you at least prove that you were there.
Also, the name of my jazz combo. I'm frightened to put the...
It should be fine. Oh, yeah. Here, let me see if I have...
Yeah, I'm looking for a coaster. There's many fine things here. I don't want to... There you go. Good lad.
That note card is...
For crap.
Oh, for God's sake. Your fancy Hollywood hussies, but you don't even have a coaster.
There you are.
I've missed your accent in this city.
You know, I'm very glad that it's not here.
I remember years ago, you were like, someday I'm just going to buy a castle, fuck off, and go to Scotland.
Yeah, and there you are. I think that what happens is that, you know, I came to LA 1995, and I wanted to get famous and make money, and I got famous and made money. There you are.
Mission accomplished.
So what am I going to do now? Hang around and do it again?
No, you know, no. What's great is that a lot of people kind of get into this space, and we've been talking about this a lot lately, about it's not enough, there's never enough, and I like that you were just like, well, I did what I said, now I'm just going to go live a nice life.
No, there's enough, for sure. There's definitely enough. I also think as well that, that my oldest son is now going off to college. You believe Milo's going to college? Did you believe that?
Oh, that that hurts my heart.
I know.
Because I just remember this tiny little guy running around your pool.
Yeah. He's going to college. He's is 6 foot something. He has a car. He has opinions.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, he has hairy legs. It's I don't wish to embarrass him. They're not that hairy. He's not like a freakishly hairy person or anything. But he's not that there's anything wrong with people being hairy. My youngest boy, Liam, I thought, well, I don't want him to grow up in LA as well. He doesn't have to grow up in LA. I'm going to grow up in Scotland.
Yeah.
So we're in Scotland now.
Now,
but I'm here a lot, you know.
Did the kids develop any Scottish brogue?
Oh, Liam sounds like he and I grew up in the same street.
He does.
Yeah. Milo can do a Scottish accent, but you know, exists in this world where, I mean, he went to school here. He's going to college in New York City. He's not Scottish. He can do it if he wants to. Like, if somebody offers him a part in Outlander or something. No, he's too Scottish for that. But you know what I'm saying. But it's all good. I like it. I like being there. I like being amongst my own kind.
I love Scotland.
Yeah.
It's just... It is like a magical...
It's the best. It's fantastic.
Just carpeted with green, and it feels it just feels nice to be there.
Yeah, I mean, in the winter it's carpeted with slush
of course.
It's dark, and that's the way it is right now. And I'm in California, and it's, you know, that's okay. It's why I got here on Monday. It's now Thursday. Is that right? Thursday?
I think it's Thursday.
Yeah, and I'm still a little bit like, this is okay. This is okay. I'm waiting for it to wear off. I'm like, this is all right.
Well, it's not, you know what? It's okay to visit.
Yeah, it is.
Because you're...
But you still live here. This clearly is not rented accommodation. You still live here.
We still live here. Yeah. I think we're pretty rooted here for the while until the ocean swallows us up.
Yeah.
But until then, we'll be here.
The island nation of California.
That's right. Yeah. We'll be a sovereign nation.
Yeah, that will happen one day in the future. In a post-apocalyptic dystopian whatever, it'll happen.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny. It's like... I think people tend to think of California as like, nah, it's just a bunch of liberal hippies out there. Where you're like, well, you know, maybe San Francisco and Los Angeles might, but there's a lot of
California.
A lot of California out there.
Than
there's a lot of gun-toting.
Bigger than Britain, California.
Oh, yeah.
But there is a lot of gun-toting. There's gun-toting in LA as well. Not the gun-toting. Toting. If people just toted their guns, that'd be fine.
Right. It's a nice tote bag.
It's the, if you just put a little tote bag, put your gun in it.
It's the firing of the guns
gym.
that really.
Just take your gun at the gym.
Look at these guns. No, the actual guns.
That's right. See what you did.
See what I did
there?
That's
very good. Are you doing Vegas anytime soon?
Oh, my God. Have you done Vegas recently?
Many times, yeah. Recently, no.
But I am doing it soon, actually. I'm going back. Although, here's the thing. It used to be, now, you'll remember this. It used to be when you did stand-up, you went to a city, there was a theatre in the city, you went to the theatre, you did stand-up.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what you do is you go to the city, you stay in a hotel in the city, then you travel outside the city to the casino,
mm-hmm.
where you do stand-up. They pay you 10 times as much, but the people there don't want to see you.
You're just a distraction.
Yeah. But you earn more money. It's an interesting thing.
Yeah.
There's all these casinos everywhere, stand-up games. So in Vegas, I don't play Vegas anymore. I'm playing some casino in Henderson, I think,
uh-huh.
which is outside of Vegas.
That's right. Yeah. But the other upside to it is that it doesn't affect your career in any way because mm-hmm. a lot of those people are so disinterested in everything that it's not going to, it doesn't matter.
You're just a break from the compulsive gambling, and I think that's all right. It provides a service also.
Absolutely.
I think it's fine.
Do you tour pretty nonstop back home?
No, I never tour at home.
Really?
No.
I don't think you would.
No, I don't work there. I work here. I don't really, I'm toying with the idea of doing the Edinburgh Festival this year, as doing a stand-up show, like one night. But I don't know. I quite like the fact that the only people that remember me in Scotland are cab drivers over the age of 50. And if you know anything about the life expectancy in Scotland, there's only about 4 of them. So it's fine. I quite like it. It's not that I'm not Chris Pine or something. I'm not like people, you know, recognize me all the time. But I love the idea that there's no chance of being recognized. Like, they just don't.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
It's great.
And you've chosen to, because to me, there's so much opportunity to tour that whole island
mm-hmm.
on if you really wanted to, you can tour a landmass the size of California
yeah.
on a loop. If I could just tour California around and around and around and
do you
around,
still tour? Are you still touring?
Yeah, but I got to go all over the place.
Well, that's America. It's a big country.
You got to do your thing. Too much of it.
No, it's the perfect amount.
No, you start in London. You start small, and you work your all the way around. You go all the way up. You go to Glasgow, to Edinburgh, come back down the other side, and then you end at the O2. That's how it works.
Well, I don't know about that. That seems like some fancy tour, and I'm thinking a bit more about small theaters, maybe 100, maybe 50 seats.
Now what, because this is a fascinating point of view to me and certainly to people who are listening or people in California or America who always think bigger, better, bigger, bigger, better, bigger, better. And you love the idea that you've been able to create a more intimate life for yourself.
Smaller is better.
What happened between the young guy who came here in the 90s that was like, fame, success, money, and then is like, I don't want anyone to recognize me. I'm going to go to a country where I can just be anonymous.
I think the age, which is a fabulously advantageous thing. If you're lucky enough to get older, I highly recommend it because there is that odd sensation of the corporeal decline is, you know, it is what it is. But the notion that you really start turning into like the old person who doesn't give a fuck is fascinating. Like you generally like, nah, I don't want to do that. I don't give a fuck. It's $1 trillion. Yeah, I don't care.
You know, it's not going
to change my mind. What's it going to do? What am I going to do? Buy something I can't afford and then do another thing for $1 trillion?
Right.
It doesn't matter. It's a hamster wheel. And, you know, I don't care for that. Not that I've been against hamsters, although I don't like hamsters.
you're really taking a strong stance.
Well, you know, I'll tell you why I don't like hamsters. You have hamsters when you were a kid?
I did.
Meet an animal more suicidal than a hamster? The hell-bent on breaking a young child's heart. All the hamster wants to do is get behind the refrigerator and die. That's all they want to do.
That's what they build.
They get down there. It's a rodent death cult.
You know, they were sent by God to teach lessons about life and death to children.
Well, I don't appreciate it one little bit. Every pet I had when I was a kid was sent by God to teach me about life, and particularly the tortoises, of which I feel terrible about.
They live a long time, though.
Well, under the right tutelage, perhaps, but given to a...
Not in Clan Ferguson.
No, in the 1970s in Scotland, with somebody with a woeful record of animal husbandry, I'm afraid, no, they did not. I feel bad about it. I said, oh, he's hibernating. It's July. He's just hibernating. They told me the tortoises were hibernating. I had about 3, I think. It's not illegal to keep tortoises.
Is it illegal?
I think it's illegal. I think it was cruel. they need to be able to wander slowly across vast open spaces.
They need to run in wide open.
Yeah, they
got to
run. They got to feel the warmth in the side. Yeah. But the streets have no name.
That's right.
That's what the tortoises want.
At heart, they're all of U2 song.
They are.
So now the difference is that turtles are more Joshua Tree and tortoises are more
a zoo station.
Zoo station.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think you're right about that.
They're slower, but they're gonna live, kind of like, a little pedantic, and not really their best. Come on, they could do a lot better.
Yeah. Do you still listen to U2? I don't really listen to U2 anymore.
I listen to, like, for me, U2 is Achtung and Before.
Okay.
I didn't like. There are a couple, like, you know, there's some catchy songs on pop. They got real poppy after that, and I don't mean that in the music
snob
sense.
Poppy's good.
Poppy is fine, but I just mean, like, I think they're an interesting study in what, you know, it's like when you're young, your art is always an expression of kind of what you're going through and what you're experiencing. And a lot of their early stuff was very about, you know, social change and rebellion. And then it was just like discotheque. And listen, discotheque is fine, but it's clear, like, they're all having a nice, they're all very comfortable.
Right. It's very difficult to write songs about turmoil when you're, when you're very happy.
Yes. Yeah, which I'm assuming they are. And, you know, because they're still.
I don't know. I sat behind them on a plane once.
Did you talk to them?
No. I wouldn't dream of doing that. But I sat behind them on a plane, and it was Bono and The Edge sitting in front of me, and I could hear Bono talking to The Edge. He was like, every now and again he would say things like, "Here, down that situation in Sarajevo was looking very bad there," and then you could hear The Edge going, "Mm-hmm." He's trying to sleep and stuff.
There's like an old married couple. Oh my god!
No, the old married couple I really did sit behind was Michael Caine and his wife. Before I met Michael Caine, right before I did the late night show, I sat behind him and his wife on a plane from London, and he's a real chatterbox, Michael, and his wife and. And so he's on the plane. He's going, "Do you think they've got any of these chocolate things that I like on this?" I mean, he just non-stop the whole way.
I've never pictured Michael Caine as a chatterbox.
Oh my god,
he just won't stop.
He won't stop. You think? Have you ever met him?
No.
He's super friendly. He's one of the nicest people you'll meet. I mean, really, he is. He's Henry Winkler level nice.
Oh yeah.
I mean, that's crazy nice. Like Henry Winkler, people think show business people are douchebags, and many of them are.
Sure.
It's true, but. Henry Winkler, like, he played the Fonz. That was like 50 years ago, maybe. 45 years ago. People still 45. Go up to him and go, "Hey." And he goes, "Hey," back to them.
He's the fucking
friendly.
Best.
Like, if that was
through
me, I'd be
through.
Like, they go, "Hey." I go, "Go fuck yourself. You fucking A. Don't fucking A me." Hey, I used his thumbs. Put your fucking thumbs away. You fucking.
You're gonna break your fucking thumb off. How fucking dare you?
Get out of here. Get off of my lawn with your thumbs.
Henry is legitimately through and through.
Unbelievably nice person. You know, Joe Bolter, who was the front end of the pantomime horse when I was doing late night, and he's now directing. He's a big timey showbiz guy now. He was telling me that when he was a PA, a production assistant on the late night show, sometimes he had to go to Henry's house, you know, and like deliver, you know, information about little sketches or scripts or stuff. This is before you emailed everything.
Yeah.
And he said, you go to Henry's house and Henry would say, "We're just having some tea. Do you want to come in and have some tea?"
Oh.
And he'd be like, and Henry would go, his family would be there and they'd give him a sandwich and stuff like that. Now remember, this is a kid he's in a production, his diet is whatever candy he can steal from the green room.
That's right.
And Henry Winkler is giving him delicious sandwiches.
Maybe what we would come to find out is that the sandwiches are poisoned and that he has a basement of
in the Netflix documentary that'll come out. I've gone down a deep hole of Netflix documentaries recently.
What are you watching?
Well, I found that my new favorite thing to watch is documentaries about bands that I hate.
Okay.
And I end up loving them. Like if the Rush documentary, I'm like, because I hate Rush. And then I watch them, I'm like, these are the greatest guys ever. I'm a dick for not loving Rush.
Sure.
And then Anvil, the story of Anvil.
Mm-hmm, right.
Fabulous movie about a band that I didn't care for until I saw the thing.
Yep.
The Journey documentary, same thing again. Then I go and see Bohemian Rhapsody. Now I like Queen again.
You know, it's almost as though everyone has a human story. And that if you're open to new experiences.
God, you want to tell me about the Easter Bunny now?
Please. He's called the Edge because he's always on the edge.
He's just very on edge with Bono. He's like, not
please.
On the edge at all.
He's fine.
He was on the edge.
He's fine.
Now he's on the couch. They should call him the couch.
The couch. Just very comfortable.
And ladies and gentlemen, this is the couch.
He just pushes a button on a guitar pedal, and yeah. It just goes... Rawr, 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 rawr.
It must be hard. I used to think that. It must be hard if you write a song when you're 18 years old, and then you get to 70... What age is Jagger? 74?
Probably.
Still singing that song. I wonder how that feels. It's probably okay now when you're in your 70s. When you're in your 40s, it probably hurts.
Because my guess is that your relationship to the song... changes, because I, you know, a comedian thinks like I could not tell the same jokes for 50 years.
Yeah,
well, but most of them anyway.
I could,
and
I hearken back to those days. I used to have that argument with Rickles all the time.
Oh yeah,
yeah, because Rickles did the same act for 40 years. I was like, it was easier for you guys, and he was like, nah, shut up, it wasn't easier. I was like, yeah, it was. You write an act and you're done. You do it in Vegas a couple of times and nobody films it. You know, I mean, it's like it was easy.
I guess so, but your relationship would change over time. But with Rickles in particular, because I think everyone was clamoring to try to get Rickles to do a podcast.
Yeah.
And I don't think he ever did. I don't think he did. But his whole thing was like, nah, he doesn't want to talk about comedy. He thinks it's gross and it cheapens the thing. But I was at your house for a Christmas party once, and you introduced me to him, and I knelt down, and you said, Chris is a stand-up comedian. You are? And he talked nonstop about comedy, and it was so hard not to be like, I just want to record this for me. I'm not going to put it out, but I want to hear everything that this guy's saying.
Well, the thing about Don, I think, is a generational thing, because Don, he was a beautiful man. And like, he was a beautiful man, but his act was quite acerbic. And, mm-hmm. you know, actually, it would be totally unacceptable today. He'd be
very caustic.
He'd be torn apart mm-hmm. by, you know, the Twitterverse would go crazy with what he was saying. But what he did was he separated himself from his act. He was, you know, he's a very sweet man. But what he did on stage was his business and his job. Like now, when you do stand up comedy, you do a podcast, you do a TV show, you're on a panel show, you do like it's all those different things where it's all kind of aspects of the same thing. He didn't really do that so much. You know, I guess he was an actor.
But I think those comics back then. I think it was also the difference of the mentality between now. Because we're a lot more spoiled now, performers think of themselves as artists. And I think my suspicion is that those people thought of themselves as like blue collar work, like that's your job.
Well,
like,
there's that and also gratitude. Rickles, till his dying day, believed himself to be lucky.
Yeah.
Now, whether he was lucky or not, I don't know. I don't think so. I think he was a hugely talented artist. But he believed himself to be lucky. He had gratitude. And because he believed himself to be lucky, I think he was happy.
Mm-hmm.
That and he had Barbara. And, you know, and Barbara took care of him. And they were like such a great partnership.
Right.
That I think that he felt he was very lucky to be with her.
Yeah.
You know, and he had a sense of gratitude about his life, which I think is difficult to achieve, no matter who you are. But particularly now when... like everything, you know, like, you know, social media is all about perceived reality that rather than an actual reality. And so people look at the supposed realities of other people's lives and become depressed that it's not theirs.
Right.
It's an odd thing.
But the gratitude, especially, you know, when you are in recovery as we are, the gratitude is a nonstop element of that.
Well, it kind of, if you're doing it right, I think, or if you have any chance of remaining healthy.
But it
mentally,
is hard sometimes.
Of course it is. I mean, you're a human being, and sometimes you're like, yeah, why do I have to do that? You know? But it's, but I think gratitude is a spiritual tool. It's not a moral prize. It's just something that you need to have to be healthy, like maybe dental checkups.
Right.
You know, it's there's no real morality attached to it. It's just it would be a good idea to have it.
Right, right, right.
I'm talking to myself here, really. I don't want to try and tell anyone else to have gratitude. I need to remember I have gratitude.
Did you feel a weight lifted when you didn't have to do a show every day anymore?
Yeah, I think that actually it wasn't really on that day. When I was doing late night, when I decided I was going to leave. Now, you and I talked way before I left about I was going to leave. And you're like, you're crazy. And I'm like, I know. And then And then I, when I, you and weirdly enough, Larry King were the two people that said, you're crazy. And I was like, no, I'm going. And then you eventually, I mean, and both Larry as well, you came around to the fact that, yeah, if you don't want to do it, don't do it.
If it's not fun,
if it's
no
not
point.
Fun anymore, don't do it. So when I made the decision internally, and I mean, like in my body that I was going to go, paradoxically, of course, the show got more fun and actually became a better show because it was going to be over.
Yeah,
and I actually think that helps. I don't think it's good for people to continue to do the same thing. You know, show business people to do the same thing over and over and over again.
Yeah, I know, but I also it was I thought you did such an amazing job at bringing an authentic conversation into late night that did not exist previous to your being there. Those moments where you would talk about your sober birthday, right. or just riff at the top and just talk about your day in a way that wasn't like set up punchline. I mean, like that was really
it was a thing.
That was weirdly groundbreaking. So it's weird to say like it was groundbreaking to just be authentic, but it was groundbreaking.
I don't know if it was groundbreaking or just a momentary aberration because I couldn't do it now. No one would allow it now. I mean, what happened was that David Letterman owned the time slot. So, you know, I was shielded. So it was an aberration in television history because the, you know, Dave owned the time slot. So CBS couldn't really tell me what to do. Mm-hmm. And so the amount of corporate hypocrisy, which is, you know, you make choices about that. If you, you know, host a game show, you know, I've done that.
Sure.
You make decisions about yourself. You know that you are going to have to behave in a certain way or toe a certain line because you're working for a giant corporation. But I didn't really have to do that much. And I realized because Dave owned it and Dave didn't care.
Right.
You know, Dave was like, say what you like. I don't care. And that was it.
Yeah.
Yeah, he didn't bother me. So it kind of, I don't think that'll happen again because the show is now owned completely by CBS and, you know, they're, I believe they're going through a transition period right now.
I have your old dressing room because Talking Dead shoots on your original stage.
Oh, man, that's right.
So every Sunday I walk out to where I used to sit across from you.
That's funny.
Yeah.
That's funny. Do you know I've never seen one episode of The Walking Dead?
It would make my show very confusing.
It would be difficult for me to do
it. If you
it.
Hadn't seen it.
But it's one of these shows that I did it the same with Boardwalk Empire. Hadn't seen it, then went on tour and watched the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah,
And
yeah.
I think that's what will happen with Walking Dead.
It is. Well, you'll have a lot of runway. They're in season 9 right now.
Yeah, well, I've done eight. That before. I did that with... No, I didn't do that with The Wire. The Wire, I kind of was there right away. But The Sopranos, I did that.
Yep.
And yeah, I just like, I love doing that, like going a deep dive in a show and watching it evolve quickly over time.
It is fun. It's edifying in a different way. But I do think we can get spoiled with binge watching. Because like, you know,
yeah.
When you live with a show week to week, it really kind of nestles into your soul.
Mm.
But when you binge watch something, it's like, it's great all at once. And then you're done and you don't think about it much
after
that.
You know, what you're saying is, you know, pace yourself. And I think you're right. But pacing myself has never It's never really been my forte.
I mean, you still have the heart of the guy in the punk band. I always thought of you as
so,
the heart of the guy in the punk band.
So I mean, your heart's your heart. You know, that's it. Your essence as you get older. You know, things do change, though. I mean, I'm intrigued by that. I hope I'm gifted. You know, a little more time because I'm intrigued by that. I really think differently than the way I did when I was a kid. Like really differently. Or even 10 or 15 years ago, I'm like, nah, fuck that. You know, something happened today. I don't really have to go into the specifics, nor should I. But I got a big offer to do something, and I'm like, nah. No, thanks.
Too much.
Yeah, no thanks. I'll be away from it. I'm working on my pond in the garden.
But if that's what makes you happy, then that's important.
Right, and I think that's... otherwise, what were you doing it for in the first place?
Right.
You know? I mean, but it's tempting, though, to go back into the game sometimes, but nah.
I mean, the thing is, if you ever feel like that's something you want to do, then you'll do it. And if you don't, and that's sort of...
I don't know. Dave Chappelle talks about it. It's very easy to get out of show business, but it's very difficult to get back in. He did it all right, but it's fun. Once you go, you know?
Yeah, but the grind is something... It's the same as, like, touring, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, when you're in it, it's, you know, you feel the work, but it's a little more seamless. And then when you don't and you go back, you're like, oh my God, yeah, how does anyone do this?
Yeah,
for
no, it's
a,
hard.
You know, so
do
you really
do
have
you
to
tour learn. Properly? Like, do you tour with a bus and a thing?
No, I did a bus tour once and I didn't really like it. I just go, like, I'm doing 10 dates. By the time this goes up, it was between February and June, I'm doing like 10 cities.
Oh, right.
So like every few weeks,
yeah,
you know, so
yeah.
It's not that bad.
Yeah, that's the thing. I do it in one go.
Yeah, just get it all
out. Land and get on the bus and stay on the bus and then get off the bus and we're done.
Do you write pretty regularly or do you just write whenever you get
up? I kind of write all the time, you know. So, I mean, it's kind of a thing that I do that, you know, writing's kind of like going to the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's something you probably want to get done at least once a day.
Some of it hurts coming out.
Yeah, and then sometimes you do a lot and it's a surprise. And other times you're like, I really hope there was more.
All that for that?
Yeah, really? What a surprise. Oh, well.
Just camp out here for a while.
Yeah.
How long did it take you to write the book? Was the book something...
No idea.
Was this your idea to come up with a book? Or did someone say, hey, do you want to write a book?
No, it was my idea. It was... I decided I wanted to write some... I began writing the book before I knew it was a book. I mean, what I did was I wrote some stories just because I felt like writing them. And then I thought, oh, no, I can thread these together. I can see how this works. And and that's how I ended up writing the book that I wrote. It was an interesting experience because I didn't have anything to worry about. I didn't sell it until after it was written, you know. I mean, actually, that's not true. I sold it when it was about halfway through.
Mm-hmm.
And then I worked with an editor who I really liked. I think that, like, a good editor is an amazing thing. Like, you especially if you read later books by great writers, they're usually bad because no one wants to edit them.
Oh, right.
You
of
know,
course.
They're too long. Like the you know, the early Harry Potter books, much better than the later Harry Potter books. The early Stephen King books, much better than the later Stephen King books. I really believe that. I know people will disagree with me, and that's their prerogative. But I really think, particularly, there's been a couple of Stephen King books. I love Stephen King's writing, but there's been a couple of his books I'm like, we've just done 400 pages we didn't need.
Well, it's sort of the difference between Sunday, Bloody Sunday, and it's a beautiful day.
Yeah, that's right.
Like,
yeah,
you know.
Like, but the thing is, when you're trying to manufacture all this grinding stuff, and you're like, oh, can we just get out of here? Come on, let's move on.
Well, the grinding stuff, you know, like that torment, that expression of torment... At the core is torment that you have to live through.
You have to share it. You have to live through it.
Yes.
Why can't we just have an editor cut the torment out and someone explain it, you know, quickly and efficiently in a page?
But I just think later in life, you know, it's like, yeah, I don't want to live through torment all the time for the sake of art. And you look at, you know, like the people like Rickles or Joan Rivers or, you know, people who...
I miss Joan Rivers.
I miss her too.
I loved Joan Rivers.
And that the crazy thing is she didn't have to die then.
No, I know.
It wasn't even a natural cause.
Yeah,
and she's still...
Horrible.
She'd
story.
Still be on stage now,
She's a voice that could be well used right about now. I loved Joan Rivers. Loved her.
Her warmth as a human being and her... You know,
I never met her.
You didn't?
No, I just only as a comedian. I just loved her as a comedian.
As a person,
yeah.
She was super engaged, checked in, a listener, and it gave insight, especially if you saw her documentary, A Piece of Work.
Yeah.
To why she was able to thrive and survive for so long because she never stopped being curious. She never thought she was above anything, even despite what her stage persona was.
Right.
And she never stopped asking questions, being involved, trying to learn. And she was amazing. Amazing.
Remarkable comic.
But I don't know if, you know... I don't know if I want to be like scrapping it at like scrapping for jokes at 79, 80 years old.
No, I won't be. I tell you that. No, it's not. It's a different thing, though. It's a different time, and there's a lot of people doing it now, and there's a lot of different audiences. Like, you know, if you're an 18-year-old or a 20-year-old kid, you're not watching the same comedians I'm watching. You're not watching me. You know, I mean, it's. Everyone's got their own little niche now, I think. And I blame you for that.
It's my fault.
Yeah. But
I'll take that.
But it's people watch what they, you know, it's like even with the news, like you watch the news that will reinforce the stuff you already believe.
That's right.
I mean, it's a different game. I don't think there are such, does this sound terribly old and bitter thing to say, but I don't think there are such big stars now, genre crossing people like Beyonce and stuff, I guess. But
there's a few, yes, right. People like Beyonce for sure. But you're right, because when we were growing up, there were only a handful of outlets,
right?
So there wasn't a lot of choice. Like right. It was like, well, everyone kind of had to come together,
right?
Because there was only three channels. And only, you know, certain records would put it. So this is, oh, everyone loves this, you know. So 40 million, you know, it's like 40 million people watching The Tonight Show every night.
Right. I mean, and now you got like, there are people on YouTube my kids watch. I'm like, my son will watch another kid play a video game.
Yeah, yeah.
And talk about it while they're playing. Like, why is that a thing? He's like, shut up, Dad. And I'm like, all right. I'm like, well, but why are you watching? Why don't you play the video game? Do I sound like a grandpa saying that? I mean, what is that?
Well, because it's, I mean, rather than go through the effort of play the game, you get to enjoy the story and have a guide for the story at the same time.
All right, man. I guess you keep saying that. Maybe you'll believe it. I don't know.
It's just that, you know, when we were a lot younger, video games, it's like you couldn't really do a let's play of Frogger. Oh, so I'm going to cross the street right
pong.
Now and pong. Now I'm going to go to the left.
Yeah.
Now I'm going to the right.
It's going to go doot-doot.
Oh, it's going to scoop. Oh,
I like
you
when
got
it. That.
Right in the middle.
The best bit.
Yeah, that was the best. That little glitchy. Best, so there really wasn't much to narrate.
Although when I think about it, one of the greatest documentaries I have seen is The King of Kong.
Of course.
And that's really basically watching somebody play video games, isn't it?
It is, but...
It's a human story, though.
It is watching video games, but it is basically watching personalities clash.
Oh, man, it has everything. The villain...
In an epic way.
Yeah, the hero called... I mean, it's fantastic.
And I think, if I'm not mistaken, I believe Billy Mitchell was ultimately stripped of the title.
Eventually, yes.
Yes.
Yeah, he was. Yeah.
For, you know, some stuff.
Yeah.
That wasn't...
Cheating.
But it... The thing is, you can be passionate about anything, and it's fun to watch people be passionate about anything. That's the human connection point. Even if you don't play video games, you can watch.
All right. Well, then there's like, let's not take that then, but let's take, you know, we're talking about, you know, diverse performer audience interactions. Like, I know there are whole niche performers who, like, people who do stuff on YouTube. I've never heard of them. You may have, because I think you're very connected to these things, but I'm not. I know what YouTube is. But I've gone a different way with all this. I don't have a browser on my phone.
Yeah.
You know, I haven't been on social media in over a year. I don't. Now I'm on no media at all.
Well, I'm headed that way. I'm not on a lot of social media anymore, and I don't spend time like basically just because it's. You know, a couple of years ago, I started feeling like this feels addiction. Like, I know what addiction feels like.
Yeah, for
sure. I know what those little chirping birds in my soul feels like.
Right.
And so I don't think I'm as connected as I used to be, because at a certain point I was like, you know, I think I need to be healthier. I think I need to kind of live more in the real world instead of worrying about what's going on in the digital world, where I don't know if anything is real, if anything is true, if anything is, you know, it's just so much energy and it's just all toxic.
It's too much for me to, you know, the best description, it was an odd source, but you know the country singer Trace Atkins?
Yeah.
So I'm talking to Trace once and I said, you on social media? And he went, I don't want to have any truck with that stuff. And I was like, I don't know, poison and shit. And I was like, wait, why? It's only a couple of people. Come on, Trace. It's only just a few people. Most people are nice. And went, that's not the way I look at it. It only takes one person to take a turd in the pool for me not to want to go in it. I was like, done.
That's the perfect.
Done.
It only takes one person to shit in the pool.
One person to shit in
the
pool.
Craig, it's a couple of shits in the pool. It's not like a thousand shits.
Right. It's only a few turds. Just swim up the other end.
Just swim around them.
Yeah, no. And it kind of landed with me when he said that. I was like, you know, you're right. I like Trace a lot, and he's, you know, he's got a great voice. And when he talks like that, you kind of listen, you know? I mean, and that's the way I feel about it, and I'm glad to be away from it. It's very freeing, very liberating. I'm very glad I got out of late night before it became, you know, really a farm for viral work,
right,
which is what it is now.
Of course.
You know, that you, it is just a place where you make pieces on TV to, for, in the hope that people watch them on their phones the following day.
Right.
I really believe that's what it is now.
Yeah, because you're basically chasing, you're having to chase, you know, it's like all of television. They're just so desperate to not hemorrhage audience, and so they need attention, and so everyone's right, just like, what can we do? We got to create it. And you're basically just chasing trends and hoping that, you know, people pass your shit around.
Yeah, and I don't care anymore. I really don't.
That's beautiful.
It is.
It's a beautiful place. Like when you said, like, I'd rather just be working on my pond.
I really would.
On such a deep level, yeah. I understood exactly what you mean.
Well, if you want to talk ponds, I've actually finished one pond and I'm starting a new pond.
What's the pond that you finished?
Well, the first pond, I had this little parking area, much like the parking area in front of your house here. And it looked like a parking lot in front of my house. And I'm like, I don't want to have a parking lot in front of my house. So I thought, I'll put a pond in. Now, I thought you'd just dig a hole and put water in it.
Right.
I couldn't have been more wrong.
That's how you learn.
So, you know, I get the pond guy comes over and he's like, oh, no, you're going to need some. And we get the liner and the thing and we dig the hole and the liner goes in. And that. But here's the thing about a pond. You put a pond in and pretty soon nature will take care of the rest for you.
Mm-hmm.
Like moss starts to grow in the pond and it creates oxygen in the pond. And like the birds start coming and they eat little things. And then little critters come to the pond.
The ghosts of those turtles you killed?
Yeah, I didn't kill them. They died.
Okay.
And all of these things start happening. And I started this little ecosystem and I became interested in it. And what I realized, the pond is a pond, but I realized that show business, and LA is particularly bad for this, that show business had become all I did was show business. All I did was I talked about it. I hung out with people who worked in it. My kids, their friends' parents were all in show business. Some of their friends were in show business, even though they were at school. This is a one industry town, and that's boring to me. And when I moved, you know, out of here, and when I spent—I mean, I still come here. I still have friends here. I still like it here, but I don't want to live in Los Angeles and be inside all that. Los Angeles is like the internet. It's only dangerous if you take it seriously. But if you take it seriously, it'll fucking kill you.
Of course,
you know. And you have to say, you know, it's all right. It's just a lot of noise. I'm going somewhere else. And what I like about being in Scotland is there's plenty of people in show business who live in Scotland. Plenty of people who are in show business who work in Scotland and are involved. But there's plenty of people who aren't.
Right.
And that helps a great deal. I like that.
So being exposed to like real life situations and things in the real world and nature and those things is somehow gratifying to the soul, it turns out.
Not just that. I remember once thinking, this is very recently, I was in IKEA in Glasgow and I had ordered some flat pack furniture that was pretty big. I don't mean to show off, but I can afford some flat pack furniture.
From IKEA.
Yeah. So I'm in IKEA. Now, if you buy a larger piece of furniture from IKEA, you don't just take it. You have to hand in a ticket, and then they'll go to the warehouse thing, and the guy will bring it to you. So you get in a line. So I'm sitting in a line in IKEA with a bunch of people. You know, there's like the guy with one eye, the guy with the hump, the lady with the, you know, it's just like a whole mess of people
sitting. Cross-section of humanity.
Right, waiting for flat pack furniture. And I was in Glasgow and it was raining and I got this overwhelming feeling of, I've not been so happy in years. I have no idea why it came to me in IKEA, but it really did. And I think it was because it struck me again, like very recently in Glasgow, I had to go to the eye doctor. Now, lots of people go to the eye doctor, but here's what I did. And this, I know that you are a person who lives in LA, so you'll understand this. People who are not involved in this may have difficulty understanding it initially. I went to the eye doctor on my own. I made an appointment, and then I went to the eye doctor on my own after to follow up on that appointment. I got the thing. You know, they looked at my eyes and said, okay, here's the new prescription for your contact lenses and your glasses. I paid for them, and then when they were ready, I went and picked them up myself, and no assistant was involved at any point in the transaction. I did it all myself. Now, I know that sounds like a horrible, overprivileged thing to say, but I really was cool with it.
Well, because what I think what you're talking about is appreciating the fact that when your world gets smaller, it simplifies.
Yeah.
And when you're waiting for flat pack furniture, there's nothing complicated to navigate other than that line that you're in and handing in your ticket and getting your flat pack furniture. When you're here, everything is so complicated, and there's social politics, and there's politics, and then there's digital media politics, and there's so many ways that you can fuck it up in so many ways. It sucks.
I think that Los Angeles is like the court of a mad Austrian emperor in the Middle Ages. You know, there is the manners and the, you know, that you have to kind of like remember and bow the right way and do the right thing. I'm like, I can't do it anymore. I don't want to do it.
I think social media is King Joffrey from Game of Thrones. Yeah, well, just this mad boy king that has a very sadistic.
I think that it, you know, I realized, look, I don't wish to blow my own trumpet, but I think we all know I'm probably the coolest person in this building right now.
I don't think anyone will disagree with you.
Okay, now, so
the tattoos and the earring and the fact that there is a full mop of hair on your head looks amazing.
Yeah, thank you very much indeed. And what I'm saying is, when I realized that Twitter was a chat room, I went, oh man, I'm way too cool to be in a chat room. I shouldn't be in a chat room. I have to get off of this. And then now I know that people on Twitter are like, but wait, Craig, you have an account. Well, you have a Twitter account. I go, yeah, I do. And my pal Tomas puts up my ticket dates on that. And that's all you'll see up there. There's no pictures of my kids or what I had for lunch. That's over. It's done.
Right.
All that stuff. I never put up pictures of my kids. But there's no personal connection. It's not happening. You want a personal connection with me? If you desire that, and I'm not saying that you do, but if you do, then come along and see me when I'll be in your town. And then we'll have I'll do a show.
Now, when you first left the show, was there a period of time where you had to like, how much was the decompression time? Because whenever you finish something, you know, just whatever, it's like, you because I did a late night show for a while, and you're almost holding your breath the entire time. Oh, we got to get through this today. Yeah, okay, what happened? Okay, oh, we almost got.
You did midnight.
Then you finish, and you're like, you know, you breathe.
Yeah.
As much fun as it was, and it's one of the favorite things I've ever done, you breathe, and then do you start processing the last several years that you were holding your breath? Is there a decompression period for you?
I think that sounds like it was for you, for sure. I think for me, like, I'm a bit older than you, I think. So I think I was more tired. and I think that I was so ready to go.
Yeah.
I mean, I was ready to leave that show in 2010.
Oh, wow.
And I left at the end of 2014.
Yeah.
Now, that's not to say I didn't enjoy it in the years. I did enjoy it. I'm proud of that show. I'm happy I did it. I'm grateful I got the opportunity. I think it was a good show. But when I left, I was so grateful to be out. Now, you're right. Transition, even if you seek transition, it's still disconcerting sometimes. And I think probably I overcompensated. I put in, you know, other work and shows that I probably wouldn't have done. Like, I did a show for the History Channel, and I think,
I was on that show.
Right, and you were good on it, but I probably shouldn't have done that show. I was just like, oh, I better do something. I didn't need to do that show. I just did it. And I did some other things. I thought, I probably shouldn't have done those things. But I was out of the habit of not working compulsively all the time because I had done a late night show every day. Like, I did that show through the death of my parents. I did that show through my marriage, through kids being sick, through shingles, through flu bouts, through, you know, through ups and downs and ins and outs. I was there. I never missed a day on that show, you know. And then when I look back and I think that was the wrong way to do it. Like, when my mother died, I pre-taped a bunch of shows and went back to Scotland for the funeral and then came back. I didn't say, you know what, guys, I'm going to take a couple of weeks off. My mother just died. And no one offered it either. You know, see, when you think that, you go, like, people in show business always talk about you, they're your family. And you go, well, no, you're not. You know, no, you're not. You're a bunch of people I work with. And I understand the desire to create camaraderie, and that's good with people.
Well, they tell you that while you're working with them because things are going well and they want you to know that. But, you know, I mean, I I went to work the day after my dad died very suddenly, and I have to say I'm glad I did because it was a tremendous distraction for that day. Like, it just, it gave me
my
a
dad,
little...
My dad, I did the same thing. Yes, I agree with you on that. With my mother, it was a different thing. I shouldn't have done it. I shouldn't have done it with my mother. I should have stayed off work for a couple of weeks, and I didn't, you know. Well, and, you know, it is what it is. You know, it happened. But I look at it now. It was funny because I remember saying to my mother years and years ago, I said to her, I'm crazy with work. I've got too much work. I'm psychotic with exhaustion. And she said, oh, but that's a good psychosis, isn't it? You know, because if you're psychotic from overwork, that means you're working. And I'm like, Mom, I don't know if that's really a thing.
But her
there is good psychosis.
Her generation, though, exactly, it's like you were lucky to have income. And
it's
stuff,
that thing
you
said about Rickles, you know, it's the idea of gratitude and being able to...
But listen, it's not my place to disagree with you on this, but I disagree that you did it all wrong because I feel like had you not taken that journey, then maybe you wouldn't have gotten to the place where the best thing in the world was that you were in line at IKEA waiting for a flat pack to come. No. You know, it's like,
listen, I'm not saying that is the best thing in the world. I was just shocked at how much I enjoyed the line at IKEA.
You were content. You were happy. You were happy with the present because you didn't have to worry about the distant future or the distant past. It was the perfect little microcosm of, I'm just thankful to be here alive in this moment in a human experience with a result that's easy to get, and then I'm going to fucking leave.
And then, you know, the bonus of easy to assemble flat back furniture at the end of that
then it gets very
little
upsetting.
Tsunami.
Yeah.
I have to say that I feel like IKEA could up their game a little bit with the flat pack. I think they're putting flat pack ahead of assembly.
The gloves are off.
I'm just saying. And I've no wish to confront the Swedish behemoth, but I feel like they could just make the game a little easier.
Yeah, I feel like there's probably like a way you can peel the directions apart from the front and the back, and then you basically see the outline of that little wrench with the eyeballs just pleading to be saved.
Yeah.
Like there's a lot
they
of...
They have those weird tools that only work on IKEA.
That's right.
Come on.
Yeah, it's not metric, it's not imperial, it's IKEA, you know.
Still playing the game.
No, they're forcing
come
you
on,
to come
Sweden.
To their come on.
We're counting on you.
That's how they're slowly taking over the new... They're not neutral about anything.
Yeah, we were totally neutral at all times.
Gets his man a flat pack.
Yeah.
Well, some meatballs.
Take the Erktop 23. I don't know.
Are you feeling good in general still? Like good?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I mean, look, I'm a human being. I have ups and downs. But I feel like I'm more concentrated on mental health, spiritual and emotional health than I used to be. Because about 18 months ago or so, I started to feel extremely uncomfortable. I mean, I would describe it to you as a dry drunk. But
sure.
I mean, to explain that to people that don't know what it is, I had all the hallmarks of an alcoholic except drinking. I was restless and unhappy and really bad. And I started to get weird. What happened was I got a root canal and I got given a painkiller after it. And the painkiller, like, I was very concerned about taking a painkiller because of, you know, you got to be very careful. If you're a recovering alcoholic like me, painkillers are how it can really fuck you up. You got to be very careful.
And they're very insidious because the doctor tells you to take it and then you're in pain.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So I resisted it, but then I was like, no, I was in real agony. So I call, you know, the man in the 12-step program that helps me, and I talk to everybody, and everybody's around me, and they hand me it was a Percocet. They hand it to me on a pair of tongs, and it's like this dry ice coming off it and all that kind of stuff. And I take this Percocet, and it takes the pain away. I didn't get high.
Right.
It took the immense dental pain away. But something happened after it. I didn't take it for very long. I just took it as long as – just to not be in agony.
Right.
And I thought, well, I'm fine. I skated. I took the painkiller, took the pain away, and that's fine, and that's good. But for about 2 or 3 weeks after it, I became fixated on the idea of going to Juarez in Mexico and getting drunk. Now, I've never been to Juarez. I have no connection to the town of Juarez at all. I don't know anything about it. But I became utterly focused on that I was going to, and it took all my years of experience and help and support network to not go to Juarez and get drunk. Now, what the hell is that? Some kind of episode, and I could only find my way out by doing what I did when I first got sober, which is contact the right people, talk to the right people, get it out in the open, admit it, say it, you know, flush it out of myself. And I still am not quite sure how it got that dark. But I think it's something to do with a lack of self-care. You know, that you have to kind of like, am I all right here? Just check in with yourself a little bit. And I kind of wandered off the path a little more and a little more and a little more. Didn't all happen in one day. I did not go to Juarez and get drunk, thankfully. I don't know why Juarez. I'm still not sure. I think because I thought, if I get drunk in Juarez, I'll go into the wrong place and someone will take me out. Because I know Juarez is quite a dangerous town.
Right.
Or I don't know if it is. I've heard that it is.
Sure.
So I thought, if I go there, get drunk, I'll say the wrong thing, the wrong person, the wrong place, and that'll end it.
Right.
And so it was a kind of dark.
So that was
time.
Do you think that was the core of it? It was basically a self-destructive.
Yeah, it was a self-destructive thing. It was a self-annihilation impulse, which which has passed, it was a surprise.
Well, it's very important to everything you did was very important, but then also the recognition that it passed is
yes.
supremely important because when you get consumed by that, whether you're in recovery or whatever, it's real hard to see, like, you're just falling in a ditch and you're going to get out.
Yeah,
it's
very, very hard to see that kind of stuff at the time. Yeah,
no, it doesn't.
It's very odd. I think what I learned from it, if anyone's experiencing a similar kind of thing, I know a lot of people do, is that I noticed that what I did, if anyone's interested in getting themselves out of it, that I worked contrary to the way I felt. So, you know, I knew that, like, for example, going to a meeting, I didn't want to go to a meeting, but I knew that I had to go to a meeting. So I just did it. I did it, though I didn't want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I knew that I had to go for a walk. I knew that I had to go outside. I knew that I had to talk to somebody about it. I didn't want to do any of these things, but I did them because I desperately needed something.
Yeah,
and I was desperate enough to do stuff that I didn't want to do. Just like when I got sober, I was given the gift, I suppose, of desperation.
Well,
but it's kind of humbling when you think, wait, I thought I had this kind of under control.
Well, that's the thing, is that it is an ongoing process.
Sure,
and that can sound daunting to someone, like, you mean I would have to deal with it my whole life? Yeah. You know what? You're going to have to deal with something your whole life, you know?
Well, you said, like, you know, I cleaned my apartment 4 years ago.
It's done.
I don't have to clean it again.
No, it's not really how it works.
No,
that's
I know
not really
what you mean.
You don't go to the gym one time.
Right.
And so I think that's...
Well, I did.
Yeah, of course. One time and your apartment's
like,
perfect.
That's enough.
But that's why it's important to, I think, engage in things that you don't necessarily... Like stepping outside your comfort zone for things that are constructive. Like, I know, you know, this is a much dumber example, but I've had the same... guy who's trained me like exercise for, gosh, I don't know, 13 years maybe, 12, 13 years. And a lot of days I do not feel like going and doing it, but I know if I can get my body there,
right.
my brain will follow.
Right, that's right.
And that to me is so helpful to the world where it's like, yeah, because your brain only wants you to feel good. Your emotional brain only wants you to feel good in any given moment.
Right.
And it doesn't discern that might be overeating. It might be charity work, but it also might be drugs or sex. And so you really have to be empowered by knowing that you are not a – you don't have to listen to everything your brain tells you you should do.
And also a little bit of self-knowledge, I guess, it is the thing that I used to think – I mean, I mistake symptoms, physical symptoms in my body. And what I mean by that is this. Sometimes I can feel like – you need to hear a piece of fucking truth from me.
Right.
But really, what that is that I need something to eat. Like,
you have to look at the chart.
Yeah.
You need to listen to me. Oh, he just needs
some
toast.
I'm just actually hungry.
Can I just have a piece of toast or something, please? Like, I have low blood sugar.
Like, you son of a bitch. Wait, it's bagel. It's a bagel. Sorry, it's a bagel.
Right, yeah.
No, but here's the thing. The converse is true. Sometimes I might think, I'll just have a bagel. When really what I should do is tell you something you need to fucking hear.
Sure.
You know,
so the wires are crossed.
Right. So, and the trick is to not get caught up in, 40 bagels a day when really you should be sticking up for yourself, and I think that's self-knowledge is difficult. And I think it's only possible with taking the perspective of other people who you trust.
That's right.
You know, so you can't just decide you know yourself. You have to talk to people who are seeing it from a different angle.
And that's okay. And it's not, I believe some people, I don't know. I just think it's strength. It's not, I say to people, it's not weakness to tell people that you're vulnerable. Like it's a human and it's important.
One of the gifts of age is like, I don't give a fuck if you, what you think about whether I'm vulnerable or not vulnerable. Fuck you.
Yeah.
Like, you're so fucking powerful. Wait till it's your turn at 4 o'clock in the morning in a fetal position in some fucking shitty hotel somewhere.
Right.
Cause you're going there. Don't think you're not going there. And it's like, everything's great in my life. Really? Fuck you, fucking liar.
You're Henry Winkler.
Well, even with Henry, I think Henry is probably at some point going, gosh darn, I don't feel so great. I bet he has. And he would admit it too.
Of course he would.
Because I don't want to go on about Henry, but that, I think that's what it is. I think you have to kind of know yourself a little bit, because otherwise people are going to make up a story about you and you might believe them.
Right.
Especially
if you are looking for something, looking for a purpose, looking for something to hold on to. I mean, we're just constantly looking for something to hold on to. And sometimes that's darkness, unfortunately. But in those moments, what are a couple things that you, what are some of the tricks to sort of pull you out?
Neil Gaiman. Yep. Said it best. Life is a fatal sexually transmitted disease. So you might as well enjoy it.
I don't think it's ever been put any more plainly or perfectly than it.
He's a pretty good writer.
He's pretty good at what he does.
He's pretty good.
As a matter of fact,
I haven't seen him recently. Have you seen Neil recently?
He lives in Minneapolis.
Did he go back there?
I don't know. I don't know if he's been. I know American Gods is gearing up again.
I don't know
if they're shooting it or they're about to shoot it. But I haven't seen him around these parts.
I haven't been around these parts in some time. He's got a baby now.
He's got a baby now. Yeah. They have a baby.
Do you have a baby now?
We do not have a baby. No. Unless my wife's been hiding one.
No.
She would have had to have hit a pregnancy.
Yeah. No, the last time I saw you was at the wedding.
I think it was at our wedding.
Yeah. Yeah. There were some other people there as well.
I don't know. That I remember. I think it was just you.
Monster thing. How many people were at that wedding?
There were probably close to 600 people.
Oh, my God. It was crazy.
I know. Well,
I've had movies that didn't have as many people see it as your fucking wedding.
But I'll tell you.
What?
The thing that I loved about our wedding was the thing that I was resistant to about our wedding, which is that Lydia made everyone check their phones at the door.
Yeah.
And it was fucking great.
Yes.
And I argued against it, and I was wrong. Because everyone was engaged, checked in, they remember the night, no one was trying to capture it, they were just fucking living in it.
Yeah.
And it was great.
No, it was fun.
We're never in those.
Do you know what was weird is I sat next to James Corden at your wedding. That's where me and James Corden and our wives, we sat together.
I don't know if I knew that.
Yeah, it was fun.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, we had a good, it's the first time I spent any time with
him. Oh, hello.
Hello. I said, I'm sitting there. Yeah, for now. That's my seat, not anymore.
Oh my God, the best joke of the wedding, and no one heard it.
It's funny, I've been saying this to someone recently. I like James, he's a lot of fun, and he's very good at what he does. But for 10 years, I was on that show, I worried about my weight and my accent. And then after I quit, they put in a fat guy who's got a worse accent than me.
Didn't have to worry about it anymore.
I could have been enjoying the fruits of my success.
I had no idea that happened. That was a, you know,
Some details of the wedding.
If you'd have let us take our phones in, then we could have.
You could have tweeted about it, then you would have taken selfies and stuff. I can't tell you how much I love you as a human being. The first time you were on the podcast was in the first few months of the podcast, mm-hmm. which was June of 2010. And we did a live show at Largo.
Yeah, that's right. You were so much fun.
You were our second live show. Adam Savage, I think, was the first.
Yep.
And then you came to Adam's show, and then you were like, hey, I'd love to do the podcast. You want to come be on the show?
Cheeky monkeys.
It was phenomenal. And you were – and we became friends after that. And I always – I have such a special place in my heart, especially as someone who's just a hair older, who has more experience with sobriety and who has navigated these things and who has always made me feel like, you know – yeah, whatever you're going through will probably be fucking fine. Yeah, it's probably going to be fine.
It'll be all right. It's fucking, who fucking cares? You'll be fine. Go to IKEA, get some flat pack furniture.
Well, it's because I know that your book, Riding the Elephant, A Memoir of Altercation, Simulations, Hallucinations, and Observations by Craig Ferguson.
Well done.
Is man. Full
I,
of.
I feel like you really pushed it. There.
I really did. Is full of. Like, there's nothing about the way that you present any of it is like, it's a perfect sunny morn. It's just like, hey, there's pain and it's flawed, but you do the work and it's worth it, you know?
You do the work and you don't get to see it, but what else are you going to do?
Right.
You know, I mean, the truth is, it's, I think in time, this will happen again. But in recent years, the way that the world has gone, I feel no obligation to tell the truth to the press. But I feel a certain amount of obligation to tell the truth in the written word. Because mm-hmm. that's for longer.
Right.
You know, when I'm gone, that's still around. So I kind of want to make sure that, even if it's not technically correct, I mean, in the sense that there are events, and I don't know if it happened in that day or if it happened 10 days later, or if he was really there or if it was really another guy. You know, it gets patchy in places. But what it is, essentially, is an emotional truth.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's ultimately the aim of all things for me.
Well, and I think that's what you brought to our culture, and I think that's what people loved, and I know that's what people miss about seeing you, you know, somewhere on television every night.
Oh, well, you know, there's always the occasional cash grab that might that might show up or might have already showed up.
I don't know, maybe. I don't know. It sounds like you're turning down cash grabs left and right.
Not all the time. That flat pack shit doesn't buy itself.
Well, I wish you a safe journey back to Scotland.
Thank you, my friend.
And it's I hope to come busy. I want to see your fancy pond.
Yeah, I put in 10 goldfish.
Yes.
And it's gone crazy. It's gone crazy. It's like there's goldfish as far as the eye can see.
Goldfish.
Well, as far as the edge of the pond.
Goldfish be fucking.
I tell you, man, they don't mess around. I put they cost me £1 each. That's like $1.30 for each fish. And now I got easily $600 worth of fish.
I mean, that's a good return on your investment, right there.
That's the game I'm getting into.
Or just a good meal for after the apocalypse.
Nah, I'm still vegan.
Oh, shit. Yeah,
even after the apocalypse, I'll be like, do you have any non-dairy creamer?
I can scrape some of the moss around the goldfish.
Do you have any non-dairy creamer? I really don't.
No, I'm a zombie. This is the apocalypse.
Well, you're not a vegan zombie, so...
Yeah, there's a plant growing off my arm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Where'd you get your protein?
I love you, Craig Ferguson.
Right back at you, son.
The end.
You've just listened to the ID10.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
NT Podcast number 998 with Mr. Craig Ferguson, who again, I mean, his willingness to just be open about his struggles, not only for himself, but just for other folks out there. And it's one of the things that I loved about him on television is that he would talk about anything. I mean, he really was an open book and a really authentic human being.
and voice on the television. And so I thought a lot about the, and I still think about it, the impulse that he had to go basically to go to Juarez and get drunk. And I really, yeah, I don't know. I really wanted to, really want to talk to him more about that at some point, because, you know, there are a lot of things that can happen why when you think, and I think this is sort of the takeaway from it, you know, no matter how covered you think you have something, like, you know, he's been sober longer than I have by a lot and still occasionally has struggles. And, you know, we all have struggles once we think we've got something covered. And so it really is important just to keep checking in, just to make sure to never feel like you're above that, because that's very prideful and that can get you into a bad situation. And he wasn't in this situation. He was the opposite of prideful. He knew that he was going through something. He knew he had to talk to people. He knew he had to follow steps. He had to consult the right people. And then he somewhere knew that, as awful as it felt, that it would pass because he had that experience. And that's hopefully what you will feel when, if you're going through something similar. And again, who knows, you know, the fact that he had to take Percocet, he did it under supervision, but, you know, maybe something biochemical happened, you know, like when you put things in your body that you're not used to taking, it can do fucked up stuff to your brain and make you think weird things. And a chemical thing can result in an emotional reaction, as, you know, either with that or like he said, like, oh, I just need a bagel. I'm not actually angry about a thing. You know, maybe there was a deep-seated subconscious thing of guilt that, you know, he has had to take this thing and he hasn't had to do that in so long. And maybe his, somewhere deep inside, you know, his brain just kind of wanted him to punish him or feel bad for something that he really didn't really sound like he had a lot of choice in doing. But the point is, he identified it, he took the steps, and he got through it. And I'm so glad that he shared that. And it's just more reason why I respect the man so much, because, you know, whatever you're going through, just know that it might not be as real as you think it is. I still, even just yesterday, I was grousing about something that was bothering me and kind of worrying and catastrophizing. And I Lydia was like, ah, you're fine. Don't worry about it. And we pulled up right behind a car and this bumper sticker, which has one of my favorite sayings that I was shocked to see on a bumper sticker, was, you don't have to believe everything you think. I know I've said that here before, and it bears repeating, because it's hard to remember that when you're having an emotional reaction to something like, you know, I was having yesterday, or like Craig was having when he was going through what he was going through. And, you know, just because a thought or an impulse or a compulsion enters your brain doesn't mean that you have to obey it. And I find that to be so empowering, because, again, we don't have to be led around by things that maybe are emotions that are the result of baggage that we have or trauma that we've gone through, or even, again, just some sort of a physiological response because we haven't eaten or we haven't had enough water or whatever it is. So just know that your brain is doing the best it can, but you don't always have to listen to it. And you can take a step back and say, okay, I think this might be a part of something else, and I should not be ashamed to go talk to someone, to get the help I need, to get back into a program if I was in one before, or hit the program a little bit harder, or hit therapy a little bit harder, or lean on some friends for this period of time, just to sort of make sure that I'm okay. It is 100% not a weakness, it is a strength to be able to identify that and ask for help. Everyone needs to. It's very human. We shouldn't think of these things as being, you know, these big dramatic productions. They're just part of humanity, and it's normal, and it's okay, and you're okay. So take care of yourself. Again, you are worth it. I will remind you that every week. I appreciate you. I appreciate you for listening. I appreciate Craig Ferguson for being so open and for talking about this stuff. Every other voice out there that normalizes this talk makes that many more people feel okay or feel like they can open up or feel like, hey, maybe I'm not broken. Maybe I'm just a human being and things don't have to be perfect 100% of the time, and that's okay. So that's it. I hope you have a wonderful week, and I will see you next week again in your ears. All right.
ID10T scanning complete. Enjoy your burrito.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.